All right, let's try it again.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I knew that would resonate with Kevin. All your bass are belong to us. I don't even know what that refers to. It's just something online.
It was a meme long ago. A long ago
maybe
meme.
Maybe the original meme.
Yeah. It was one of those.
I don't think it was the original meme. But.
So Ryan, I don't think we have to get into the dust up, but it is at least noteworthy, I think, that you're joining us tonight. So thanks for coming out. Good night, everybody. Drive safe.
Ooh. All right. See you guys later.
Wait, bye. What the fuck are you talking about? I have literally no idea what's going on in here.
Well, A, I was late, and B, I had a thing happen a little while back.
Yeah, which is not. We're not trying to get into the thing. I was just going to make the comment that, like, that due to the fact that you just came from the doctor's office, I guess, a while ago, that, like, part of you, like, you look surprised on one side of your face and then, like, just really unimpressed on the other side.
It's not quite that.
I think so.
This is me looking surprised, Shane.
Yeah. Ryan opened his eye a little bit. And
for everyone out there, Ryan's doing fine.
Ryan got his eye cut.
We're really glad that he's doing well.
And yeah, all that's
he's
true.
With us and all
I'm
that.
Doing so. Fine. Someone is being prosecuted in the end.
Yeah.
So we get into theme music?
I was going to say, on that note, I mean, I think that's a good way to kick it off. I'm Shane.
Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Mark.
Somebody likes it.
Hey, so I don't know if this came to light before the last time we got together and recorded, or maybe in the intervening time between, but I did come across what has been referred to as the headline of the year so far, which is that this popped up, I think, maybe in the Guardian, the headline is Radiohead crowd left red faced after applauding 3-minute guitar tuning, mistaking it for a new song. Apparently,
is that for real?
Yeah, apparently
that's
that really
hilarious.
Happened. Tens of thousands of Radiohead fans embarrassed themselves at Glastonbury Festival this evening after mistaking the band tuning their guitars for new material. Many tweets were sent from members of the crowd during the incident, some claiming it to be the band's best work since OK Computer. One fan described it, this is my favorite part, one fan described it as, quote, minimalist but also complex, emotionally raw but still able to push the boundaries of what music can be.
There's no way that's actually real, man.
It's a legit.
It's not the Onion or the Hard
no,
Times.
No, it's a.
It's on BBC.
Yeah, it's a legit headline. So anyway,
I mean, it's not that surprising. I mean,
they noodle.
I'm very much on record as loving the Bends and OK Computer, and they just released the 20th anniversary edition of OK Computer with a bunch of new
demos new versions and stuff of some of that.
Was not released. But that is not all that surprising.
If you're going to go out there and make a really strong claim like that, then you're a fucking, that's, I mean, I guess that, I mean, it's emperor. I guess that,
I mean, it
you could extrapolate that to like criticism or you know, like blog, music blogging, you know, it's pretty emperor wears no clothes.
Well,
kind of shit.
And there's this human nature to like be the first to break something, you know.
That's what Twitter's all about,
and I'm sure that's what Twitter is all about, exactly. Yeah. And so it's these people sitting there listening to this shit, going, "Oh my god, I got to let everybody else know about this before anybody."
But can't
else
you does. Imagine like that stuff is just it starts trending, and then you know you're watching it all. And you're
wait,
like,
Kevin, can you reread the long review
that
guy posted about
it? One fan described it as quote minimalist. But also complex, emotionally raw, but still able to push the boundaries of what music can be.
I can't believe that's not an Onion article. I want to know if it's an Onion article and BBC just picked it up.
If we're all just pumped,
I love that
then
so
I'm,
much.
I'm gotten great with
here,
it.
Here, about 3 or 4 months ago, I waited on a guy named John Greenwood, and I dropped his card back to him, and I was like, you know that you are the namesake with one of the most amazing guitar players of all time. He's like, you know what's funny? I was at that he was probably in his 50s. He was at a party a few weeks before, and a couple girls just kept laughing that his name was John Greenwood. And they're like, oh, Johnny Greenwood, and like they were huge Radiohead fans, and I was like, dude, you really should live in. He's like, I actually do play guitar. But he was just more into like folky and country stuff.
Imagine if he did know a bunch of like Radiohead songs, like hooks from over the years and stuff that Johnny Greenwood had written. Well, Johnny Greenwood also did a lot of the keyboard stuff on, and he composes all the stuff for Paul Thomas Anderson's movies, like the last few movies he's done.
He's a prolific dude.
He's not just prolific; he's a fucking genius. So yeah, I mean, if I were that dude,
what's
that dude's gonna
read,
go?
Read again, Kevin. What's the last line?
Well, now I pulled it down. Minimalist. Like, now I don't have it. So
still able to push the boundaries
of what music can be. Yeah, I mean, not wrong, but yeah, they were tuning up.
Yeah, this was reported by a Welsh reporter.
Reported
this. So
the damn Welsh.
Anyway. So never dull moment. I'm just saying that if you're like here's the funny thing to me is like it does nothing to diminish my love of Radiohead. Like I still think there are some things that act has done that are pretty transcendent. But holy shit, like that speaks to the seriousness of the way that people listen to that band.
Well,
and fucking Twitter.
It speaks to the seriousness of the way that people listen to that band or attach themselves to that band. But it also speaks to how superfluous and surface and hey, look at me, that fucking Twitter and shit like that is. I mean,
oh, sure.
Exactly.
I will say that that is the way I feel about a lot of jazz, where people are just going like,
people
this
are
is mind-blowing, and like literally they're tuning up. Very well could be.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that struck me. That was a little bit of funny, so I had to bring it in.
Well, we're here to talk about something entirely different from that.
And probably, at least to some extent, less funny.
Yeah, I didn't find it all that funny.
But also not depressing.
Ironically, no. Or
is
maybe
that irony?
No, maybe that's on the nose.
Yeah. Yeah.
No Depression by Uncle Tupelo. Which just sounds like a fucking Sunvolt record.
It does sound like this is the way that I think about it. I'm going to be Ryan for a second because Ryan is a genius at doing this. And I'm not saying that I am a genius because I'm not about doing this. This is what this album sounds like to me. Well, number one, it sounds like that really good local band you like to go see at a club. And then number two, it sounds like if you were to take like an R.E.M. cover band and have them start writing replacement songs and have Shane McGowan sing them. Like that's exactly what every single song on this.
Well, like with a little bit of like an Irish twang to it.
It sounds like Shane McGowan. If you listen, yeah. Jay Farrar
from the Pogues.
Of the Pogues.
Yeah.
Jay Farrar definitely developed, as did Jeff Tweedy, and we're gonna have a long talk about Jeff Tweedy in a minute about this because
he barely makes an appearance on this record as far as
like
I can tell.
He sounds like a. I just have things I want to say about this because Jeff Tweedy was always seen as the lightweight in this band.
Well,
like, he's not anymore.
No, post this career?
Yeah. No.
They have gone on two divergent
things
paths.
Things switched a lot. But, I mean, here's what I felt about this. I felt like this album, I was actually talking to Derek Morris about this earlier today, about how when he said, yo, you guys just did Astral Weeks. And I was like, yeah, well, we didn't come to, you know, altogether a good conclusion. But I remember listening to that song with you or that album with you when we were on a road trip. And like when you're on a road trip and you're driving around, there's music, like it's kind of can be better or make you in a different place than you would be if you're just like driving around town or listening to stuff at your house. I think this record would be great like on a road trip, like some kind of record on there. You're not really paying attention to it. You're not really listening to the songs, but the songs are bad.
They're not bad, but I wasn't blown away at all.
No.
But given the influence this record
but
had?
It's the same thing we always get into, you guys. Like, it's how can you listen to it with your fresh ears from 20 years ago? Like, the fact of the matter is like, it's all, you're always colored by the space in between. And to your point, Shane, like, they do sound a little bit like a certain type of bar band because there are a lot of...
They're better than bar bands.
Well, you know what I mean? I'm not necessarily...
I'm just saying local band. They sound like a really great local band that like, you like to go see live.
Damnations, Graveline.
Sure.
Like, I could probably name off another half dozen, but those are all bands that were influenced by this record.
Well, let me point this out. Like, I think I think it's less this record... than Anodyne, their coup de grace, their last record, which is by the time you get there, like I think it's 3 years later than this one. I mean, that record blows this shit out of the water. But it's like we've talked about before. There's a lot of time. Like if you listen to the difference between Pablo Honey and the Bends. One of those is not that great of a band, But all right, one of them is one of the best albums released in the 90s. I mean, and that took place over 2 years.
Yeah, well, maybe I should have picked the other one, but that's not the one I picked.
Well, I know, but I'm saying if we're going to talk about, like, you were saying about, you're talking about this record influencing these bands. I don't think it's this record. I think it's this band that influenced bands.
Well, like our friend Bill Davis.
Sure.
Like,
sure, but Bill
this
Davis.
This band changed his life.
Yeah, this band, but not this record. Anodyne is the one where people really, really latched on
but
to it.
But this is the one that, like, the whole, like, the magazine and the magazine, genre, they founded a genre.
Sure. I don't think this founded the genre. I think the magazine about alt country founded this. If you go and listen to their subsequent records, then you hear a lot of country stuff. There's a couple of kind of country songs, not the least of which are Jeff Tweedy's shitty songs, which, by the way, the shittiest songs on this record are Jeff Tweedy's songs, in my opinion. And he sounds like a...
Kevin wants to say something.
Oh, sorry.
I'll get there. Yeah, so, well, I mean, so let's, I mean, where to begin? Jesus. So, like, first of all, this is the first album by a band that I think the reason it seems to be fairly, not unanimous, but it seems to be a ground that gets traveled over and over again when people talk about this record, and to a greater extent, this act. The thing that is remarkable about Uncle Tupelo, aside from the fact that they did something, really what it comes down to is that they had old, traditional, storied country influences and punk influences. And those were two things that at the time weren't seen as congruent. Like you would follow either one or the other, and there was a whole set
of
like
effluvia
that went with that.
Stop-start dynamics and faster tempos. I was actually playing this record for my roommate last night, and he thought it sounded like Dropkick Murphys, and I was like, "Well, not really."
Yeah,
but,
because
I mean,
singer sounds like he's Irish. He sounds like Shane McGowan.
The Pokes thing, it gets brought up sometimes. I think
I'd never
even
thought of that before.
But, yeah.
But I had never heard this record before. I'd only heard the one after this, and then Anodyne, the third one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I
get
think
more and
like,
more country every album. Like sure. By the time you get to Anodyne, it's pretty alt country. That's kind of set that template.
Yeah, I mean, and I hear you about the Sunvolt stuff. Like, I certainly think that, like, you know, vocally speaking, there's no mistaking that Jay Farrar is really the lead in this, certainly on this album. And
I don't know if I heard Jeff Tweedy at all singing.
Yeah, he sings on the second song, and he sings on three songs on it. He just doesn't sound like Jeff Tweedy.
No, he doesn't sound like modern Jeff Tweedy.
Yeah,
at all.
No, yeah. I mean, I find Jeff Tweedy to be not only one of the best songwriters of the last 25 years, I genuinely feel like he is one of the most interesting, better singers. Like he's developed a style. It's
you and Kevin should make out, by the way.
I know.
No, but he does have.
He's the one. He ran away with the prize. Looking at the breakup of this band and like everybody wondering which band's going to be the one.
Well, of course, everybody thought Jay Farrar. He was the heavy hitter. I mean, Jeff Tweedy was seen as the lightweight. And honestly, I got to tell you, if you listen to his songs on this No Depression record, they're the worst songs on the fucking album. Conversely, go to Anodyne. And I think the best songs on that record are the Jeff Tweedy songs. And he's got his voice kind of developed. It's going to take a couple more years before he gets the Jeff Tweedy voice thing down and the songs really down. But you listen to New Madrid on Anodyne, and that's like, it's a slam dunk song. But his songs suck on this. And it sounds like, his songs almost sound like he was like 18 years old or 19 years old.
Well, he was later to the game. Like, yeah. In the very early beginning of this band, part of the, like, he didn't know how to play his instrument as well as the other guys, and Farrar had grown up with older brothers that played in bands, and so they got to be friends in high school, and Tweedy was really, like, he kind of looked, even though Farrar's just a year older than Tweedy, like, looked up to the guy, and because he's the one who had the experience in trying to, but they shared some of these musical sensibilities, and so it's like they're kind of trying to work all this, like, this album is a lot bumpier, I agree, totally agree, than Anodyne. Like, it's not nearly as polished, and
it's
they're
not,
not
a bad listen. No, it's just not a great record.
No, it's this is really interesting. So I knew that I had read something that Chuck Klosterman wrote about these two guys, and I found it, and I do think it's it's just worth dropping in here. So he's interviewing Jeff Tweedy, and he says, "We're waiting at a red." This is, forgive me, because it's a little long, but I'll try and go fast, and I'll maybe cut some stuff out.
Don't read it too fast, because then it's like, they sound like an auctioneer.
Anyway, He says, we're waiting at a red light, and I ask him if there would ever be an Uncle Tupelo reunion. Surprisingly, and without much hesitation, he said maybe. This shocked me because Tweety hasn't really spoken with Jay Farrar in something like 10 years. This being the case, I asked him what would be the biggest hurdle in making this reunion a reality. He said something that I never anticipated. He said, I don't know if I could play those songs anymore. Tweety said, the bass parts on some of those songs are really fast. I don't know if I can play bass that fast anymore. This obviously is crazy. This is like somebody saying that you're considering reuniting with your estranged wife after a 10-year separation, but you're really nervous that she might have rearranged the living room furniture. Yet, somehow, this sentiment struck me as remarkably insightful. It was the kind of highly important detail that normal people never consider when they expect artists to satisfy their dreams unconditionally. So this was the second thing that I realized about Jeff Tweety. Musically, he notices what is not so obvious.
Yeah. I could see that.
There it is.
Well, you know, when he said, I don't know if I could play those songs anymore, my immediate thought was, yeah, because you're so much of a better songwriter now.
But they are fast. Like, they're a little frenetic. And, you know, for especially, like,
he could do it. Just give him 2 weeks to rehearse. Like, he's just
I get what he's saying, though.
Oh,
I mean, I know.
He's just,
taking
the piss.
Well, and that's a backhanded way of saying that they're not going to play together anytime soon, which is, of course, what happened. Because that was part of a book that came out, like, I don't know, circa 2004, 2005. So it had been about 10 years at that point since they'd bumped into each other. So anyway, I saw
Wilco open for REM, and it would have been, like, mid-90s or something. It was early on in Wilco's career. And they sounded super alt-country at that point.
Yeah, they
And Wilco just diverged from the path at some point.
By their second record, that first record, AM, was really alt-country. That came out, I think, in 95. I'm blanking on it, their double record, their second record. By that then they really started to, they still had those, there were some country-ish songs, and there was a lot of experimentation. Summer Teeth was the one where
Shane was super excited about Summer Teeth. They reset the fucking template at Summer Teeth.
That's when he became Jeff Tweety. All right, well, anyway, Ryan, pick a song.
Let's do The Namesake, and we'll go from there. This is No Depression from the album No Depression.
Fear the hearts of men are failing, for these are latter days we know. The Great Depression now is spreading, God's word declared it would be so. I'm going where there's no depression, to a better land that's free from care. I'll leave this world a toil and trouble, my home's in heaven, I'm going there.
I'm going where there's no depression, to the lovely land that's free from care. I'll leave this world of toil and trouble, my home's in heaven, I'm going.
So we just listened to a little bit of the Carter Family, which to me just sounds like pretty much like Hank Williams Sr. And really, this record sounds like Hank Williams Sr., but speeded up with faster tempos and more stop-start dynamics.
I don't think it. How does it sound like Hank Williams Sr.? It sounds like The Replacements more than Hank Williams Sr. There's a couple of. I mean, I don't understand. That makes no sense to me at all.
You're allowed to think that.
Well, I mean, I'm just curious. Like, are you talking about the Carter Family that we just listened to? That sounds like Hank Williams.
It does, but it's slower. No Depression doesn't. No Depression to me sounds like Hank Williams Sr. type of country music, just sped up and, you know, given a little bit more.
I don't know. I think there's a couple of country-ish songs on it. I find their country music influences to come out more in their subsequent records than this one. It just sounds more like The Replacements, rock and roll stuff.
So this
there's a couple of country songs.
This is a little snippet from the Pitchfork take on the reissue of this record, which I thought was kind of cool. And as much as I smack those guys around sometimes, like occasionally they really have something to contribute. So, yeah, that song, No Depression in Heaven, it was based on No Depression in Heaven, which was made famous.
A Carter Family song.
By the Carter Family in 36, and then again by the new Lost City Ramblers in 59. Anyway, this guy goes on, or this lady that wrote this piece goes on to say about Uncle Tupelo and, you know, and the songs on this album. She said it's also a reminder of how, and this kind of goes back to what I was mentioning earlier, it's a reminder of how strange and turbulent an act Uncle Tupelo was. Country and punk are both vulnerable, impassioned, tenuous enterprises, and the places they overlap are especially combustible. Uncle Tupelo is typically evoked in discussions about the two outfits that it birthed, Wilco and Sun Volt, which we certainly talked about in spades here, but No Depression is a significant record independent of its fallout. Now, you know, it sounds like maybe we differ a little bit from her take on, like, how significant it is compared to this.
Well, when you say fallout, it reminds me of how much I'm ill-equipped to listen to this record, and we always use this term, with fresh ears, because I've just heard so many bands that sound like this. So it's hard to, you know, go back and hear something that, you know, maybe at the time was revolutionary. But to me, like, you know, just sounds like a decent alt-country album, which we haven't really brought up. They did kind of spark a genre.
Well, that's true.
Sure.
That's a very fair statement.
What, y'alternative, the other way to say it?
But I think that stuff really starts.
It's a funnier way.
I mean, I think that's revisionist thinking. I really feel like it really start. I mean, not about, like, the fact that they started the genre. I'm just saying that this album is what started the genre. I think it's the later stuff, the more country stuff that they did.
So give me a little bit of timeline here, because I was familiar with old 97s before I was familiar with Uncle Tupelo.
I think
old 97s were later.
They're a little bit later, but I mean, Anodyne came out in 93, and I think the old 97s really started playing around in, like, around 93, 94. Okay. So
there's some influence there.
This came out in 1990. This record came out in 1990.
But I would say the old 97s would be one that was more
Whiskey Town
of this stuff.
Was what, mid-90s?
Yeah. I mean to the point that everybody's making here, like, there were a slew of bands that were that recognized that you could put out what were essentially, like, you know, albums with a rock ethos but some country sensibility.
Yeah, like an Americana, like, country thing going on, but, you know, just being, like, you know,
I don't
balls to the wall about it, I guess.
To your point, Ryan, I mean, there is something to be said. For me personally, it's hard to get my head around any of it, because this basically was my early 20s. Like, it's any band.
Dude, we saw bands like that, like, sounded like this twice a week.
Yeah, I know. So it's sort of like, it just sounds like 21 to 24 to me, you know, like.
Yeah, it makes it harder to appreciate now.
Yeah, I mean, I can appreciate it. Yeah, again, like, I mean, you have to go. I mean, again, like you were saying, like, you know, with a lot of that water under the bridge, like, it's hard to go back and put yourself in that position, especially to enjoy it. You know, when it just sounded so ubiquitous, like, for whatever, at whatever time.
What it is now is unfresh.
You know, well, I mean, but that doesn't matter. If you don't like the songs, you don't like the songs. There's shit tons of albums that you can hear from the 60s.
I don't dislike the songs. They just sound like so many things I heard at Hole in the Wall on Thursday
nights. Yeah, and
that's
what I said. It sounds like a great local band that you go see all the time. It's not like anything that's going to change your life or anything. But, I mean, to say it like that, it sounds unfresh. I mean, that would completely diminish, like, any music that came.
Well, I suspect had I heard this in 1987, I would have been blown away. Maybe.
So this is from the Consequence of Sound take on this, which I thought was fascinating for a different reason, which is that it kind of gives this album the back of the hand for about half of it and then kind of ends in a nice place. But I thought this was a juxtaposition that I didn't actually take into consideration until after I'd read this little piece, which basically said that like, the inclusion of the song No Depression works on two levels. Firstly, it legitimizes Uncle Tupelo's love of great country music. No Depression also gives the album a wry, humorous twist. Although the Carter Family's original number is a promise of hope for those just struggling to live through the Great Depression of the 30s, in the mouths of two young Midwestern punks, quote, "I'm going where there's no depression" is a quick-witted jab at the Prozac-munching world of pop psychology disguised as complaint against Hoover-era economics. Now, I don't know whether the Hoover-era economic part...
Prozac-munching?
Like, well, I do think that, like... Like, you know, kind of like we were talking about, like, late 80s. Like, this was an era where, like, what was being kind of sold back to us as ways to solve problems were, you know, sometimes pharmaceutically induced.
Yeah, like Prozac, like Elizabeth Wurtzel's book, Prozac Nation.
Note to self, I need to figure out how to incorporate all of the air quotes that Kevin throws around while recording this podcast.
Yeah, which are great on a podcast, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, no, it's so I do think it's possible that maybe there's a little double entendre in there, which of course is a country thing. So, like, whatever.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
You guys want to listen to another one?
Yeah, Shane, you choose.
I want to listen to Whiskey Bottle, but I'm not going to because I want to play that first Jeff Tweedy song so you can just get a handle of like how different his voice is and how not great of a song
it is.
I
didn't even realize he sang any of them. Yeah. I thought it was all Jay Farrar.
Yeah, so let's listen to this, That Year. Tweedy, boy, he developed it as something better,
much better.
So that sounds like a demo of a song you write when you're like 18 years old. Like,
well ironically, that track,
there are a couple demos at the end of this record. If you listen to it on Spotify, that I actually like better than the rest of the record.
Oh, I didn't listen. Did you listen to the legacy version?
Like I don't know. It had 19 tracks on it, and then I didn't do the whole.
Yeah,
36.
The legacy has all the demos on it.
Yeah, I didn't do that one.
Yeah, so it looks like that was That Year. Looks like That Year was co-written by Farrar and Tweedy. Because it sounds like the pacing on that song is very Jay Farrar, like, which it totally makes sense
to me. It is. Like, yeah, yeah. But also, it sort of sounds like something you might have written in high school, and didn't they go to high school together? So.
Yes. Maybe they did write it in high school.
I don't know.
Oh, by the way, one thing we haven't talked about that I do think is kind of funny is that the original name for this band was The Primitives. And I was like,
I did not know that, but that's... strangely apt.
It is strangely apt. I was like, that's like what every band should call themselves before they get their
the Primitives.
Shit
together. What was it in Spinal Tap? They were called The Originals, but it turns out there was another band called The Originals, so they had to be the New Originals.
I don't remember that.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, Spinal Tap. Maybe we should watch that movie one of these days.
Everybody should
maybe.
Watch Spinal Tap at least once. If you're hearing us out here in podcast land, go watch
please,
Spinal Tap.
Let's not devolve into like Spinal Tap quotes for the rest of the night, because it's easy.
Sure.
It would be easy.
Anyway, yeah, they're originally...
Lick My Love Pump.
Shane. They were originally called the Primitives, but there was an English band also called The Primitives, so they couldn't stay The Primitives. So it's
I know
like
that band.
That you, yeah, that you...
Became the Evolved Primitives,
yeah,
and then
well,
that.
Right. Slightly, they became slightly more evolved, and then Uncle Tupelo, which actually was something like an old... poster that one of their friends drew with a Fat Elvis on it, and that was
is that how the name came? Because so Tupelo is
the name,
I assume, from Tupelo, Mississippi, which is where Elvis was born.
Yeah, I think they. I don't remember the full story, but I think that the artwork came second. Like I think they conjured the name for that band, and then the artwork came second. But anyway, they're originally called The Primitives.
Damn, that's amusing as hell. Yeah. It may be time for intermission.
Well, okay. Go on and let's do it.
Tell you what.
Hey now. So, several days ago, I texted Shane and I was like, oh, hey. Since we're covering the record that we're covering this go-round, I have a song that would be technically it's my week to pick the song at the end of the podcast, but
you wanted
anyway,
to switch.
I suggested. I was like, I've got one to suggest, and Shane was like, oh, just do the middle. So
because you really didn't want to hear Hadaway's "What Is Love."
Yeah, well, not again.
Oh, it'll come back at some point.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
You guys have already hurt me, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's anyway. Just try and grind the show to a halt. Anyway, I wanted to. I came across a track that I hadn't heard in a while that reminded me is actually oddly the first show that I moved to Austin in 1999, and it was the first. This was the first. Somebody gave me a ticket to go to this show, and so this was at this band that we're
was
about
I
to
there?
Listen to. I don't think so. It was somebody that
was
I was
it
working
Liberty
with
Lunch?
At the time. But anyway, say again.
Was it at Liberty Lunch?
It was at La Zona Rosa.
Oh, all
right. Yeah. So anyway, this was the first band that I ever saw in Austin, and it just happens to be an act that I would think on some level was probably influenced by the burgeoning alt country movement, which at this point, you know, was kind of a full blown thing. And that's the Jayhawks. And so we're going to listen to Save It for a Rainy Day.
Pretty little hairdo, don't do what it used to. Can't disguise the living, all the miles that you've been through. Looking like a train wreck, wearing too much makeup. Burden that you carry, more than one soul could ever bear. So sad. Don't look so sad, Marina. There's another part to play. So sad. Don't look so sad, Marina.
Save It for a Rainy Day off of the appropriately named Rainy Day Music record from the Jayhawks circa 2003.
Beautiful song, confusing video.
It is a confusing video. Although I got to agree with Shane's comment that he made while it was running, which is like pretty much anything with Mary Louise Parker in it is
we're going to watch it.
You'll follow that thread through to the end. But
yeah, I would watch that video. If I were at home right now, like probably would have watched it one more time because that song was fucking awesome. That was a
It's my
beautiful
second favorite
song.
Jayhawks song after Blue.
I know you love Blue. Like, you've been having a hard-on for that one since fucking 1995.
You say that like everybody knows that.
Oh, sorry. I thought everybody knew that. Yes. Yeah. At that, I've never heard that song before, and I am sufficiently impressed.
Yeah. No, they were... and as I recall, like, it was a pretty decent show. Like, I kind of got talked into going to it. And it was around, you know, it would have been.
Well, we were roommates at the time. You should have brought me.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry,
yeah,
I can't
you were living with him.
Yeah. I'm retroactively
pissed. Sorry
if
he didn't want to spend 24 hours a day with you every day.
Oh, no, trust me. At the time, you definitely didn't want to spend 24 hours a day with me.
That's
at the
what
time.
I'm saying.
Anyway.
Give
him
a little breathing room, Ryan, is all I'm saying.
I definitely underappreciated the Jayhawks when I had the opportunity to appreciate them.
Yeah, no, like, and I just thought that song's like kind of. Like demonstrative of the ethos of these kind of country like bands
country-ish,
with a little bit of country
was like that was a little that came out
it was more
right
like California
around, it came
country.
Out right around the same time as I can't think of the title of this album. Steve Earle put out a record in like 2001.
I thought this was on Tomorrow the Green Grass, but it wasn't on that.
No, this
record?
Came out in like 2003.
Nope.
Okay. What it was, I believe, is that bands in the wake of Uncle Tupelo.
No, this was they predated Uncle Tupelo.
Well, they may have been around, but I feel like labels were given more latitude to sign and promote bands in that kind of with that ethos.
Hey, can I just point this out? Like, Ryan's got this super cool like it basically he looks like his phone's like resting on like an easel
tripod.
No, it's easel, more like an easel. It's right, not like a tripod. So that way he doesn't have to do any work. Like, he just can just... It's very... I like it.
Snappy.
I'm quite modern. I don't know where you're going with that. And where you've derailed
our
line of...
It's sort of like inquiry. It's sort of like whenever you see a guy with a cell phone attached to his belt, kind of looks like that a little bit right now.
So one thing that I think wasn't apparent to me until right now, but I'm looking at the track listing from this album, and Matthew Sweet wrote a couple of songs.
That song sounded like Matthew
Sweet. Doesn't it totally
sound
like
a lot like Matthew Sweet?
Yeah, yeah. Now that I heard it, I was like, oh well, no wonder I've always kind of liked that track because. You know, although
I think we're all Matthew Sweet fans around
table. But my problem
a little too much guitar, but yeah. Well, I'm sorry, Kevin.
Yeah, I was just gonna say like my challenge is like, okay, so if he's giving away good songs to other bands, there's usually only about two really good songs on
each Matthew Sweet record
outside of Girlfriend that you know that come together. So anyway, but yeah, I enjoyed this track and I hadn't heard in a long time and it popped up the other day and I was like, oh, this would be a great episode to
isn't if I'm not mistaken. Aren't they one of the bands that, like, somebody left and, like, somebody else just took the reins? They had two songwriters. That seems like something we haven't really talked about.
Well, they broke up for a while, and then when they reformed, they broke up for, like, 5 or 6 years, and they got back together with the two principals.
Oh, so they did, but, like, yeah, it seems to me like when you have two songwriters in one band, there seems to be a little friction.
That makes sense to me.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Variation on a theme, as it were.
Well, I mean, because you have ideas of where you want that song to go. So, like, if you want your band to have a consistent direction, I mean, it makes sense that, you know, either you write collectively or you have, like, you're going to have two competing ideas of how they want their songs to sound.
It like sounds like we're getting to the other side. Yeah.
The other side here.
Do 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 do. Break on through.
Shall we?
It's pretty good, right?
Let's.
It's pretty good though, right? That was pretty good. That's pretty good.
It was like he was here.
Terrible.
Yeah, I felt like it. Okay, let's do it.
Hey, Kevin.
Yeah.
Will you read a headline for me?
Oh, sure. Oh, right. Yeah, apparently Eric Clapton just caught the year's biggest salmon in Iceland. Of course.
Breaking news. We don't do this very often. But
it is breaking news, and we're proud of the fact that we are really...
That is a big fish.
It's a big fish.
He replaced his drug habit with fishing.
Salmon fishing?
Yeah.
In
Iceland. Trout and salmon fishing. The man likes to tie a fly, apparently. And, like, good on him. I used to fish a lot.
He's got a boat to row.
Watching the Orlando Fishing Show.
Yeah, which is, like, at some point we'll have to figure out what the origin song of that is, because it's totally a cover, but they just replaced the lyrics.
I would be curious to know as to whether he just walked up to the edge of the water and started playing that Tears in Heaven song.
And the fish is like, what the fuck, Eric Clapton?
I just figured the fish is like, well, kill me now, please.
Like, well, there's two different. See, there's two different scenarios there. One is like, yes, kill me now, and the other one's like, this is the way I want to go. Clapton is God.
The quote from Mr. Clapton says, that first summer of my recovery was one of the most beautiful I can remember. Perhaps I was healthy and clean, and I began to rent some trout fishing days for myself, mostly on stretches of water in the neighborhood that had been specifically stocked for local fishermen. Fishing is an absorbing pastime and has a zen quality to it. It's an ideal pursuit for anyone who wants to think a lot and get things in perspective. It was a perfect way of getting physically fit again, involving, as it does, a great deal of walking. I would go out at the crack of dawn and often stay till nighttime. For once, I was actually becoming good at something that had nothing to do with guitar playing or music. So, hey, good on him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Don's the only crack that he's doing now.
It would... But Mark gets one really good producer mark.
Zing.
You should just drop the mic.
Hashtag. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, thanks for the breaking news, fellas.
Eric Clapton caught a big fish in a small country.
Right. In a stocked pond. So that like that's specifically what that pond is for, is to catch fish.
I don't think this particular fish was in the stocked pond, but we should probably move on
anyway.
Back to Misters Tweety and Farrar and their band.
Mark, you had something you were telling me about during the break that I thought was noteworthy.
So I got into the world of internet development and design in early 2000, and one of the first ideas I had for a website had to deal with this this idea of crowdsourcing information, and it specifically spawned from Jeff Tweedy and Jay Farrar, this idea of being able to track where music originates and where music evolves, specifically kind of like this web of
Like etymology, like not just of the music, but of
the
like
family tree of, yeah, of music. Yeah, in a sense. So let's say that you've got Jay Farrar, you've got all the people that he's played with, and that's one sphere of this web. And then you've got the labels that he's worked with, and you've got those bands, and then how does that spider out? So
well, and you look at like the Carter Family doing the namesake No Depression song, and that spawns June Carter Cash.
Exactly. So you've got and it's funny because it's actually one of the things that when you guys started this podcast that made me want to be a part of it, was because I've always had this desire to know more and more and more about the history and the interweaving of music. And it's cool that it's come up in this particular episode that hearing these things about how these guys start this thing and then they go off their separate ways, and Wilco becomes this thing and Sunvolt becomes this thing. And
you could almost argue that Sunvolt just kind of stayed this act.
But
yeah, I think you're right. No, I mean, I think that's a smart assessment, though.
Yeah.
But I see what you're saying.
But I mean, Sunvolt, you know, there were people that worked within that realm that spread out to other things.
Certainly.
So that was what I was trying to discuss with Kevin, was just
yeah,
this idea of how music spreads and evolves and the family tree and the etymology of music.
I have mentioned this on this podcast before, but it's been long enough. Like, it maybe was a couple of years ago. And so I think it's connected, so I'll bring it up again. But the one time that I got a chance to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, this is probably like...
With Cleveland Dave?
Cleveland Dave with Colby. I was not there with Cleveland Dave. But
Colby is weirdly a Cleveland Indians fan.
He is.
He's not
and,
from
and
anyway,
a good substitute.
He's not
we're
from
not
going to
sidebar
Dave
on stuff yeah people don't know or care about. But anyway, yeah, so as you walk in... and of course, it's been years, so I'm sure that they've changed this up. But at the time, when you walked in the front door of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they had this wall that, if you went up to the wall, it was kind of an etymology of sound from bands, where you could, like, for instance, the example that I remember was like it was essentially a wall of influence. So you could listen to a snippet from a band and then see where the tree went that of the bands that they influenced, and then hit the next button over, and it would play a snippet that was clearly illustrated.
Yeah, and that was exactly kind of what the ultimate idea was for me, was that, oh, I like this band. Oh, well, you should listen to these bands, because this is where this stuff went.
Well, here's the other thing that's kind of funny about it, is like, so the one that I remember was like, listening to a snippet of the Pixies and then listening to a snippet of Nirvana, who were clearly influenced by that whole start-stop-start thing. And there is some of that that's present on No Depression. So it's like there, I do think that there's some of that style. And maybe that's just the Pixies influencing everybody. But something in the water in
the
early
Beatles,
90s.
And they right loved a lot of punk stuff. But one of my favorite stories in the Kurt Cobain biography, Heavier Than Heaven, is that his manager also managed the Pixies, and he was going to be introduced to who was known at the time as Black Francis.
Charles.
Frank. And Kurt Cobain was so freaked out that he wouldn't do it. Like, he was just like, no, I'm sorry. And, like, you know, people, you know, are freaked out about Nirvana, like a lot of people are like so overwhelmed by that band that they would, had he lived, been the same way. So
there's a lot of coddling with a lot of codependent,
agreed,
people in music.
God,
that,
do I agree?
That have lots of mental issues, substance abuse issues. Like, sometimes, like stuff like that. Like, why would you not just walk across the hall and meet him? Like,
right,
it's bizarre to me.
Anyway,
he was in like the next hotel room over, and he was just like, I can't do it.
Yeah, 1 foot in front of the other people. Like, but I mean, I guess to like circling back to where Mark started, like I do think that etymology of acts is really a fascinating pursuit, and that's kind of a little bit of what we do here, right? Is like in this case, it's like we dig through the ruins of an old record and try and source it out. I do have a track that I think kind of that illustrates a little bit of that start-stop thing being present on this record. So I think for the next one, why don't we do Factory Belt?
Sounds like a good plan.
Slipping away. Looks like it's time to lay this burden down. Stop messing around. Don't want to go to the grave without a sound. Get a soul, a place to rest. Not to ride on a factory belt. Not to ride on a factory belt.
So yeah, that totally sounds like a Sunvolt track for good reason. But and one more little tiny snippet from this Consequence of Sound review, specific to like kind of comparisons that were happening at the time with the fact that Nirvana was taking over the world and some of the other things that were happening in rock at the time. Anyway, said No Depression is irrevocably one of the most influential records of the 90s. It may not have made it into as many homes as Nevermind, but No Depression, in the opinion of this guy, is at least is responsible for the way that indie rock sounds now, even though its sales figures may not make up a hundredth of that other albums. So I don't know. Like,
well, at least on that track, like so much of like the stop start dynamics and the higher tempos is what really goes into that. I mean, like it's Americana, but like right there on that track,
it's speed Americana. I don't understand where the Americana thing comes from. It just sounds like proto. Like indie rock, it just sounds like the Replacements. It doesn't sound like Americana in any way to me.
Or the Minutemen, or like yeah.
There's a lot of that stuff. I mean, just because like later on his band became Americana, that doesn't sound like that at all to me personally.
Does to me. Maybe I'm influenced by the rest of the record and the twanginess of the rest of the
record.
It's
the way that he twangily sings. It's the twang, but I mean, vocal, I challenge you to do this because you make up your mind immediately when you listen to something because of
get
stuff
so
you've heard
mad,
before.
I love it.
I don't get mad at you. It's just you're
super frustrated right now.
I am frustrated.
Broad smile right now. Go ahead.
I challenge you to do this. Go listen to this, and you won't do it. But go listen to this album and go listen to Anodyne. Listen to them back to back and tell me which one is the alt country one and which one is the proto indie rock one. They're completely different bands.
I do think it's really fascinating that like we all can kind of agree that like Sun, like the direction that has become Sunvolt sounds a lot more like Uncle Tupelo than what Wilco has become. But before to circle back to what you were saying earlier in the podcast, Shane, like AM is a very Uncle Tupelo sounding record, and it's because like
it
per Tweety, he was like, I just wasn't finished exploring that space.
Well, yet. And a lot of it was, too. Like, I mean, he essentially took the band from Sunvolt, or from Uncle Tupelo with him. So, I mean, of course, like, they had been writing those songs.
We're discussing, like, the personnel changes. So, who took what with who?
Yeah, so this is a point of some, like, I'm not totally sold on he took the band. He ended up with three guys. And
he took three. He took Ken Coomer.
He meaning Jay Farrar.
Jeff Tweedy.
Oh, Jeff Tweedy.
They became a five piece later.
But Jeff Tweedy took three of the people that were in Uncle Tupelo, and the other guy left. And then Jay Farrar took the old drummer who was no longer playing in Uncle Tupelo with him to Sunvolt.
When they were a three piece, two of the three guys are in Sunvolt, and one of them is Jeff Tweedy. So it's like, yeah, Shane's right too. Like the fact of the matter
three
is,
of the
like,
guys
like,
that were three of, like Tweedy plus three other guys, were in Wilco, and then Jay Farrar took the old drummer from Sunvolt or from Uncle Tupelo, who was no longer in the band, got him in Sunvolt.
Anyway, I don't remember where we'd started before we did.
Sorry. So anyway, so he had all of those. So what you were saying is that, yeah, I mean, like, he had all of those guys. Of course, they're writing that way. They're finding their.
So let me pause the question to you guys. If you're talking personality wise, would you think that Jay Farrar is the more dominating personality, and that's why his style dominated this band, and Jeff Tweedy was able to kind of go off and do different directions?
I think
directions.
He was the more seasoned musician in the beginning, and that dictated the sound of the band.
Yeah, I think I agree with Kevin. I think his songs were more done. If you look, like I said earlier in this podcast, like if you...
And he's older?
He's 1 year older. But I mean, but his songs were more polished. They were better written than Tweedy's were at this time. If you go back and listen to this record, I mean, in my opinion, the Jeff Tweedy songs, and it hurts to say this because of how much of a fan I am of Jeff Tweedy, are the shittiest songs on this record by a long shot.
Well, right.
Jay Farrar had... Let me say one thing real quick. Jay Farrar had a very focused and concise voice early on, and it never really changed.
No, he didn't develop at all. And you look at Jeff Tweedy, like, he's gone through all kinds of changes.
He didn't just change. He became one of the best, in my opinion, like, songwriters, American songwriters of the last 25 years.
Our friend Phil would say the progenitor of dad rock.
Right, yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
but before we sidebar onto that for 7 hours,
actually,
like, the thing about... that strikes me about Tweedy with regard to this record and then looking forward to the rest of his career has been, like, he was the guy, because he didn't start out knowing as much as Farrar and wasn't already in bands and whatever. He was the dude who was, like, sweeping up in the control room just trying to be in the space to try and figure it out. And so
he was just excited to be there.
Yeah, totally. So the impression that I have gotten is that he has hustled harder. Like, I think there's probably some of that. And talent, too, like, of course.
Yeah.
But like,
don't underestimate the talent. Yeah. I think it's work. And people don't really understand this, kind of, like, that aren't inside of that bubble. There's a lot of work, like boots on the fucking ground and just working and editing. And
No, a lot of it's like I've seen you write songs and, like, get frustrated with yourself. And
oh, you're talking about me?
I'm talking about you. Oh. But also, like, stuff that I've done, like, you know, business-wise, and there are a million little factors that can go into, like, why a band becomes bigger than another.
It's not about
band.
Why one band becomes... I'm just saying, like, it's undeniable that Tweedy is a more... if not a better writer than Jay Farrar, definitely a more expansive writer than Jay Farrar, and that comes through
more
no small part to...
Like,
and more accomplished, yeah. But it comes through no small part from...
Jay Farrar might have got bored of, like, the work and the music business too. Like,
he liked to write the songs he liked to write. I mean, we can't speculate.
Jay Farrar kind of had his thing. He was successful with what he was writing, and
right.
Jeff Tweedy was finding his own, and he branched out and he
had two different things. It's apples and oranges, and I hate to say that, but in that way. But I mean, it's far be it for us to get inside the minds of those two people and understand. You know, like Jay Farrar, maybe the songs that the stylistically that he liked to write are the ones he kept writing.
Can anybody name me a Sunvolt record other than the one that had, what was it, Drown on it?
Take This Job and Shove It.
Okay, that's a Sunvolt record?
That's actually Johnny Paycheck. I'm sorry.
Close, real close. Johnny Paycheck. By about 40 years.
Hey, so there was a Chicago Tribune article that ran in March where, first of all, Shane, did you hear anything about... tweet from Jason Isbell, the singer-songwriter from the Drive-By Truckers.
I'm very familiar with Jason.
Who had a hot take on Sunvolt and Wilco.
No.
He says, he tweeted, "I think we can now safely say that both Sunvolt and Wilco have turned out to be better than Uncle Tupelo. Hashtag alt country take," Isbell wrote in early March. It drew a long stream of responses, proof that the Tweedy-Farrar split still resonates deeply with fans of the music. And so this guy's interviewing Farrar. This is in March. I guess he was playing a show in Chicago or whatever.
Jason Isbell was interviewing?
No. The interviewer, the writer from the Chicago Tribune who was interviewing Jay Farrar because Farrar's band was doing a show in Chicago, put this to Farrar and he said, basically he said it was too many songs for one band. He says Jason has a similar perspective to draw from there. But anyway, the reason I read that little blurb is that he goes on to say that Farrar and Tweety got back in touch somewhat recently. Farrar found some old demo songs from the second Uncle Tupelo record, Still Feel Gone, and he thought they were good representations, his words, of what Uncle Tupelo was doing at the time. It was just a kind of powering through all the new songs that we'd been doing live. I felt like it was something that should be looked at for a possible release. I communicated with Jeff via email, so that was good. So they've been emailing a little bit. Who knows if it'll ever make any difference or if it should. But for one of the things...
It's amazing to me that these guys who are, like, so connected,
yeah,
with their, like, you know, like, origin story,
yeah,
barely talk. And well, they're just like, eh, yeah, I'll shoot you an email about this thing.
You know who I want to bring up? The Split. I almost want to not bring him up because
it will, Kevin's
it will satiate
mad.
Kevin in his it continued anger.
It's not necessarily anger. He's just annoyed that we bring it up every show.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So I mean, okay. So I'll leave it alone.
They're
show.
Not called the
honestly,
Joneses.
I also wasn't even thinking about that.
I won't. Like, I won't bring it up this time. But okay. Off camera, Ryan. So Morrissey and Johnny Marr got together.
Who are these people? I don't know what you're talking about.
Had a beer. And
oh really?
Oh yeah. We'll talk about it later.
I'm so fascinated.
Wait, are we recording?
Anyway, origin stories are fascinating, especially when bands that have had some success break up contentiously, and I think you could certainly make that case about the Smiths,
or about
Wilco,
yeah,
or
came out of his face. We
Uncle
didn't do
Tupelo,
it.
Or about Oasis, or about a lot of other.
It's weird how contentious it gets. You're completely right. I find it fascinating. I think that is Jason Isbell, who I think is a fucking stud of a songwriter right now.
He's an excellent songwriter.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that.
I think he's totally right. Like, the debate is settled. I mean, we can settle it on this album. I listened to Anodyne while I was listening to this, and I'm like, I would
You're
so
like,
much
I
rather
I wish I could only hear one of these.
Oh, no, I just want to, I would rather listen to Wilco or Sunvol. You know, like the Uncle Tupelo. Like, it's little kids making music, and they got better at making that music later.
Hey, by the way, I'll throw this out, and we won't have to go down the rabbit hole of this, but Tweety's wife hates Summer Teeth, which I love that record. Like, I adore that record, but she feels the way she feels. But anyway, like, yeah, I do think that, like,
Shane
crazy
loves that record.
I do too. Like,
top 10 records of the 90s.
No,
for sure.
I wholeheartedly agree, but not Mrs. Tweety. So anyway, I think that has less to do with the music on it and more to do with
living
with Jeff Tweety at the time or whatever.
Perhaps. Yeah. Well, I mean, but that album really did signify a switch.
They switched from the alt country to, like, pop genius. Stuff.
Okay, so anyway, Ryan, thanks for letting us cuss and discuss.
That was fun.
Who's got the last track here? I guess it's you, Shane.
It's me. Yeah, since we had such a good time listening to Kendrick Lamar a couple of weeks ago, he's got a new video out. Let's do some Kendrick again.
Here we go. I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck. I'm willing to die for this shit. I done cried for this shit. Might take a lie for this shit. Put the Bible down and go out for a knife for this shit. D.O.T. my enemy won't catch a vibe for this shit. Aye. I've been stumped out in front of my mama. My daddy commissary made it to commas. Bitch, all my grandma's dead. So ain't nobody praying for me. I'm on your head, aye. 30 millions later, no defense watching. Auntie on my telegram like, be cautious. I be hanging out at Tams, I be on Stockton. I don't do it for the gram, I do it for Compton. I'm willing to die for the shit, nigga. I'd take your fucking life for the shit, nigga. We ain't going back to broke, family selling dope. That's why you nanny-ass rap niggas better know. If I gotta slap a pussy-ass nigga, I'ma make it look sexy. If I gotta go hard on a bitch, I'ma make it look sexy. I pull up, hop out, air out, made it look sexy. They won't take me on my element.
It's kind of like the anti-gangster rap video in some ways. Like,
I have
dude,
to say,
but you know who that's falling on deaf ears to? Half of the country who, man, I think it's a decent song. I don't want that fucking word around me at all. And the other half of the country that doesn't agree with me politically is going to, like, see that as something that it's not.
I refuse to have this conversation. It's not your place to fucking to get in to get up there. Oh,
shouldn't be.
Are you talking about?
Here's what I think. I think that whoever shot this, like cinematically, without fail, regardless of whatever the subject matter is, all Kendrick Lamar videos are visually arresting. Like, I thought, like,
it's a beautifully shot video. It's a really good song.
What are you talking about? Like, your fixation on that word, you were completely taking you out of what that song is about. That song is about seeing violence on your block and seeing, like, then it's being glorified by the people on your block and in music and in videos.
You're right.
And it's just, I mean, what you're fixating on completely takes the message out of what that song completely is.
And you're right.
And it's not up to you to make the fucking decision of who can say that word or not.
I have a problem with that word because people use it out of context.
Was he in that video? You just make the shit about yourself sometimes, dude.
Well, I don't know.
Be pissed all you want. Like,
I'm not pissed. I'm just, you say this shit sometimes, and you refuse to, like, listen. Like, it's like you make up your, it's like one little thing just, like, sticks in your head and sticks in your craw, and you can't listen to
it. I actually think the song is good. I like the video. I like the photography.
I know, but you choose to come out of it with something that had nothing to be about the lesson of the song.
I'm not disagreeing with you at all about the lesson of the song or about the quality of the video or anything. I just know that there are going to be some fucking people in this country who are going to take
it
the wrong way.
All right, Ryan, how does that change anything?
So let's all agree that we're unified in condemning that word. Okay, so we're on the same page. Beyond that,
correct.
Like, let's talk about the song. Like, beyond the crutch of language.
It's a great video. Like, I have no problems with any of that.
I just thought, like, for me personally, I haven't seen the video, and I thought the song was decent. I felt really emotionally moved by the video, but I find it extremely bizarre in 2017 that this argument that this has been going on since 1992 that I can choose to ignore between white people that live in middle America, and somehow that takes you out of the message of that video and the song. Like, that's what you choose to fixate on?
Didn't take me out of it. I just know how some people are going to take it.
Anyway, yeah. Like, again, I think we can all agree that sometimes language can be a barrier to getting to a place of trying to, in this case, like trying to interpret art. So, where the art is concerned, and you know,
I'm
given
all about the art in this.
Given like so. You know, like within the context, certainly within the context of Kendrick Lamar's other work, like, I don't know, where did it strike you, Shane? Like, what was your takeaway within the pantheon of what he's brought to the table?
Well, I mean, he grew up in, you know, the in Bompton, like the blood side of Compton. I mean, this guy, this little bitty guy, like, chose to, I mean, his life is crazy. And so for him to, like, put some, I think it's ballsy to basically in that entire video, which is to turn the lens back on the violence that's prevalent in that community and say like, and then to say like, you know, basically say like, we make this violence glamorous, but it's not. And then to show like how it's not glamorous and go back and forth like that. I thought like a really affecting scene was where the guy was trying to teach the little kid to hit him in the face. The older man, like, you got to learn how to fight. You know, I thought that was,
yeah,
I'm totally on your level with this. I thought the intensity of this video really got to me, and yeah,
it seemed like, I said, the anti-gangster rap video, you know, it's like it showed all those guys, you know, all those gangbangers and stuff, and then it just had so many different like elements to it that that took away from that glamorization, and fully said it in the song, like, you know, this is bullshit, like glamour. Like, I'm gonna, he said like something about violence against woman, I'm gonna make this sexy, you know, like, yeah.
The point that we're having this discussion is probably like what he was even going for. My point is there are a lot of dumb people in this fucking country that aren't gonna take this the right way.
But why would you in a million years consider that when you consider art? Like, would you sit down if,
dude,
you're,
no, I want to. Like,
well,
I don't,
no,
I don't,
no, no,
go,
no, no,
watch,
no, that's,
I don't want
to
go look at
it,
like, all Robert Mapplethorpe photos.
Oh, are we talking about Robert Mapplethorpe? We're talking about fucking Kendrick Lamar, the most popular rapper in the world right now. What I'm saying is that, Ryan, if you're going to create art, be it
I'm
visual,
not telling him he shouldn't do it. I'm just saying it's going to have an effect.
How is it going to have an effect? I mean, seriously, we don't live in 1987 anymore. I mean, how is that going to have an effect? Right now, that song is the most popular song in the world.
We should have this discussion off mic.
It's just absurd. It makes no sense. And why would you...
makes no sense anyway. That I think that some dumb people who voted for the wrong person are going to take this the wrong way.
I think this can all be simplified by suggesting that if he wanted to begin discourse, he's begun discourse. Certainly happened in this room. So anyway,
and
Shane, thanks for... Yeah.
And I applaud him for that.
Great.
It's a good video. It's a good song.
Nobody wins this. Yeah. So, like, anyway.
But I think your point being that the video sparks the conversation, certainly.
As well, I think he wanted it to.
And was his point.
And like, you can also make the argument, too, that it's harder to spur... Like, people have seen everything. There are 1,000 different channels. Like... Movies go farther than they've ever gone before. Like, to really grab people by the lapel and get their attention, you have to do something that really asks people to commit to feeling. And Kendrick Lamar is not a shy artist. So anyway,
that is very much true.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
I appreciate Shane bringing it up and
sparking
the conversation.
I enjoyed
here.
The video. Shane's mad.
It's okay.
I am a little bit pissed, but not about because of that. I'm just you're taking something. You're taking, like, the smallest little element that, like, tangential element, really.
You could talk about it all day long.
I don't want to talk about it. I want to just not talk about it ever again.
Okay, so next week.
What you got next week, Kevin?
Bring it up lighter, shall we?
Next week we're gonna explore a San Francisco artist that put out her first record this year. We're just going with all J stuff. So her name, the act is called J Som, and we're gonna give it a spin next time we get together.
I was just wondering if you're gonna do something new because
it is new. It came out in March.
I know. Yeah, no, that's usually your wheelhouse.
He's the new guy.
Yeah. So anyway, and we've taken we've taken some trips back to the land of shag carpet, and in this case, old whiskey.
We shan't be.
So old whiskey. We will not do that. We will not do that next week. Anyway, until then, I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
Shane.
And I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.